This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Welcome to a new safety class, and today we're going to talk about hazard communication. What exactly are hazards and how do they need to be communicated, and what are going to be the modes or the tools for this communication? The purpose of this subchapter or subpart is to make sure that the hazards of chemicals are evaluated and that information concerning their hazards is communicated to employers and employees, so no one would be exposed by mistake. Here are some examples of major accidents that happened due to chemicals and how they affected the surrounding environment. In 1978, 20,000 tons of 240 different chemicals stored at a dump in New York City were dumped in a canal, which resulted in birth defects, miscarriages, and cancer that were reported, since this canal was used for water, for potable water, drinking water. 900 families were relocated. So you can see that it has a major effect on the surrounding environment. In another accident in 1983, a worker died on February 10, 1983, while cleaning out a tank containing sodium cyanide, which is poisonous. Three managers were prosecuted by Cook County State's Attorney. Two received 18-month sentences for manslaughter. Again, in Chicago in 1983, several workers reported being sick from vapors from wire coating extrusion process. OSHA determined that there was an overexposure to phenol and xylene. In 1989, the Illinois Supreme Court allows five executives to stand trial for aggravated battery for job-related injuries to their employees. So you can see there's a criminal charge for that. So this standard, the HAZCOM or Hazard Communication Standard, was ordered by Congress. Several states enacted their own right to know law for anyone who's going to be dealing with a chemical that's determined to be hazardous. Chemical manufacturers wanted one uniform law versus various state laws, because again, if you're going to be working in a state and you're not quite familiar with that law, you might accidentally do a violation of that law. So it would better be if it's just one law governing all states, one federal law. So what makes a chemical hazardous? Why would it be hazardous in general? It's if it becomes a health hazard or a physical hazard or a biological hazard. So these are the three different types of hazards that can make a chemical hazardous. When we talk about the chemical exposure, we talk about two different issues: severity and duration. Some chemicals are not going to be that hazardous if the duration of exposure is going to be very limited, whereas some of them are going to be hazardous even with a very short exposure. So acute effects usually occur rapidly as a result of short-term exposures and are of short duration. So acute, causing severe pain or severe symptoms for a very short period of time due to very short-term exposure. Whereas chronic, which is the more dangerous effects, generally occur as a result of long-term exposure and of long duration. That's why they're called chronic. So one of the first types of hazards is corrosive hazard, and it shows visible destruction or irreversible damage to body tissue. We can cite, for example, acids as being corrosive. And caustics or bases, some of them are also very corrosive. And then another type of hazard here is going to be toxicity, toxic and highly toxic. It can cause death or serious injury from a single exposure if it's highly toxic, by ingestion, if that's going to be by swallowing that poisonous or toxic material, by dermal contact over the skin, or mists or vapors, exposure to mists or vapor, as we have seen in that accident that was cited at the very beginning. Highly toxic means that a small dose can cause severe effects. So toxic and high toxic can cause all of these effects, but highly toxic in a very small dose can cause these severe effects. Toxic larger dose, again, is going to cause severe effects. an irritant. It's not as hazardous as a toxic or corrosive, but still it causes a hazard. It's not a corrosive, causes reversible inflammatory effect. So it can cause inflammation to the eyes or inflammation to the skin or to any other membrane. So, but these are reversible. They can be cured and reversed. Another major hazard is resulting from fire and explosion. So we're going to talk about explosion and flammability scale. We have something called LEL, which is the lower explosive limit, and UEL, which is the upper explosive limit. Now looking at a mixture between a gas or a mist or a vapor and the air. So in this case, it's going to be the fuel. If it's 0% fuel, 100% air, of course, there's nothing's going to happen. If it's a lot of air and or a lot of fuel and not too much air, a lot of fuel and not too much air, and by air here we mean primarily oxygen, then it's going to be too lean to burn. So it's not going to burn. If it does not have oxygen enough, it's not going to burn. And beyond that, we're going to have the lower explosive limit. On the other hand, on the other extreme, if the mixture is too rich, if it's 100% fuel with no air, no oxygen whatsoever, it's not going to burn. So in this case, it's going to be too rich to burn. So we have two extremes, too lean to burn or too rich to burn. Too lean, which is a lot of oxygen but not much fuel. Too rich, too much fuel, not much oxygen. And that would be the upper explosive limit. In between, that's going to be the danger zone. That's going to be the flammable range, where we have enough mixture of oxygen and the fuel, and that can cause the burning or can cause the explosion in some cases. So a gas is only combustible between the LEL, lower explosive limit, and UEL, upper explosive limit. But any concentration of combustible gas should be a concern, because it can start accumulating until it reaches the lower explosive limit. Lean mixtures can collect in an area and reach a combustible level, or rich mixtures can be diluted with air to become combustible. So we do not want any accumulation whatsoever. How are we going to communicate these hazards? They're going to be communicated through several vehicles, including the Material Safety Data Sheet, or MSDS. Remember that acronym, MSDS, Material Safety Data Sheet. It can also be conveyed through labels on the different containers, for example, through a written program which explains in detail what are going to be the hazards of exposure to this chemical. And we have to train the employees. So that's another tool for hazard communication, by showing them pictures, by showing them the actual product, and by training them on how to protect themselves against exposure and what to do in case of exposure. The major points of HazCom or hazards communication is: employees must know the hazards of chemicals such as toxicity and if they are carcinogenic, which means causing cancer. Many employees use dangerous chemicals without personal protective equipment, and that would be a mistake. The contractor must have data sheets of other employers' chemicals if their own employees are exposed. If you remember at the very beginning of this learning process about safety, we talked about the different types of employers. We talked about creating or causing, we talked about exposing, we talked about controlling, we talked about all of these different four types of employers. So the correcting is the fourth one. So in this case, if you are an exposing contractor, where you're not the causing or creating, but you are an exposing contractor, your employees are going to be exposed to the hazards caused by another contractor. You have to train your employees on recognizing these hazards and how to deal with them. Employers are required to provide information to their employees about the hazardous chemicals to which they are exposed using a hazard communication program, labels and other forms of warnings, and material safety data sheets, and information and training. So these are basically going to be the tools for an employer to communicate hazards to their employees. Labeling exemptions. There are going to be some exemptions for the labeling. If it's pesticide, it's usually going to be written on the pesticide. Chemicals covered under the Toxic Substance Control Act. So these are very limited chemicals, and they're going to be known by name. Foods or food additives. Supposedly, these are not going to be causing any illness or any danger or any hazard. Distilled spirits, tobacco. Again, their harm is already known, so people use them at, at their own responsibility. Consumer products, lumber, cosmetics, etc. You don't need to label them, although they have chemicals, but you don't need to label them as dangerous. And hazardous waste is going to have its own labeling system, so it is going to be protected in a different way. When we talk about the employer requirements, one of which is a written program. Employers must develop a written program that covers at least labels and other forms of warnings. How can people recognize the danger or the hazard from reading these labels? Material safety data sheets, employee information and training. So at least these three elements need to exist in a written program that the employer must show. When a an OSHA inspector comes to your site, one of the very first things that they're going to ask about is, show me the material safety data sheets. That's going to be in the opening conference before even going to visit the different parts of the site. They need to show, they need to see the program, the training program. They need to see the material safety data sheets, which, as we're going to see later in this presentation, must be kept on site in a certain format. The requirements for a written program. The employers must develop a written program that covers at least the list of hazardous chemicals known to be present at the facility, along with their material safety data sheets for each one of these chemicals, showing, for example, what are the symptoms of exposure to that chemical, what is the cure for the exposure to that chemical, what are the dangerous limits time-wise and quantity-wise, and so on. The methods the employer will use to inform employees of the hazards or the non-routine tasks, and the hazards of chemicals in unlabeled pipes. So in some cases we have pipes that carry a certain gas or a certain chemical that's hazardous. So if the pipe is not labeled, how are you going to notify people about that hazard? Here, for example, we have a labeled pipe. The label is put upside down for some reason, but again, the pipe is labeled with diesel fuel, so people would know that there's a hazardous chemical going through, running through that pipe. And diesel fuel in this case is going to be flammable, so that's why it's hazardous. In multi-employer workplaces, if employees of other employers could be exposed to hazardous chemicals, so they're going to, you're going to be the exposing contractor, the program must include methods to provide the contractor employees with on-site access to material safety data sheets for each chemical those workers may be exposed to. So if you are a controlling contractor and you have several subcontractors working on site, you have to make these material safety data sheets available to all of these different subcontractors so they can train their employees to prevent the exposure to these hazardous chemicals. The methods used to inform other employers of any precautionary measures to be taken for normal and emergency situations. If there was a gas leak, for example, how are you going to notify the other employers, who in turn are going to notify their own employees? The employer must ensure that each container of hazardous chemicals in the workplace is labeled, tagged, or marked with the following: identity of the hazardous chemical, its commercial name, its chemical name, its chemical composition, etc. Appropriate hazard warnings: is it flammable, is it toxic, is it causing irritation. This above labeling information is required of the manufacturer, so the employer must ensure that the original labels from the manufacturer are on all containers and remain legible. So that the responsibility initially is on the manufacturer of that chemical. They have to label their containers. And once these containers are brought to the site, you have to make sure that this label remains intact. And if it gets damaged, you have to replace it with another label with the same information. There are some exemptions for portable containers. The employer is not required to label portable containers into which hazardous chemicals are transferred from labeled containers and which are intended only for the immediate use by the employee who performs the transfer. Sometimes you might have a gas can, for example. If your car runs out of gas and you have those red gas cans, you don't find the label on this gas can. It's already known by shape and by size and so on that this contains gas, so people are going to pay attention. But in this case, you're not going to store gas in that can for a long period of time. You're just going to need it to refill your tank. So in this case, it's immediate use by the person who performs the transfer. Now here we have a problem. Here we have some gas cans that have been stored. Here we have a container that's not labeled, that's not even covered. So no one knows exactly what's in that container, and it doesn't seem to be for immediate use. So that would be a violation. Hazard assessment is going to be done through one of three different ways. DOT classes. DOT is the Department of Transportation, not just DOT. It's DOT, Department of Transportation classes. NFPA, National Fire Protection Agency or Association. 704 Diamond, we're going to talk about that in more detail, and HMIS, Hazard Management Information System Labeling. So we're going to look at all of these three different systems. The first one is with the DOT classes of hazardous materials. You're going to notice these, by the way, if you are driving on a highway behind a truck that carries a hazardous material. You're going to find some labels on that truck that show exactly what kind of chemical is it carrying, whether it's fuel, whether it's another chemical, and so on and so forth. So the hazard class of dangerous goods is indicated either by its class, name, or division number. There are 9 different classes. So the first one is explosives. You're going to find that sign on the truck, showing that it's explosive, and it's 6 divisions, 1.1 to 1.6. The second one is gases. That's another one here, 3 divisions, 2.1 to 2.3, and that's the symbol for it. It's a flammable gas. The third one is flammable and combustible liquids. So that's even more dangerous, and now it carries number 3. It has a category on its own. Class 4 is flammable solids, which has 3 divisions, 4.1 to 4.3, all under class 4. Class 5 is oxidizers and organic peroxides, which has 2 divisions, 5.1 and 5.2. Number 6 is poisons. That's quite rare to see on a truck, but again, it may exist there. And it has 2 divisions, 6.1 and 6.2. Class 7, radioactive material. And that's a class on its own, class 7. Class 8, corrosives. And class 9, miscellaneous. It's still something that would not classify under any of these 8 classes, but it's still a hazardous material, so in this case it would be miscellaneous. The National Fire Protection Association, known as NFPA 704 Diamond, lists hazards of material when exposed to fire conditions. So if they're exposed to fire, what's going to happen? Are they going to emit fumes? Are they going to explode? Are they going to be inert, or they're going to remain intact? So we need to know about that. And this is basically the NFPA Diamond. You can also see these on many trucks. So whether it's going to cause, in case of fire, how is it going to behave? In case of what is the health risk, any special hazard, and if it's going to be reactivity. So something like that, for example, it has 2, 3, 1, and W. which means it's a fire hazard. Flash points is number two, which is below 200 degrees Fahrenheit. Zero will not burn, so that's going to be safe at least to fire. And four is going to be very explosive, basically. Below 73 degrees Fahrenheit, it can ignite. Health hazards, this one is extreme danger, three. Number four is deadly. Number two is hazardous. Number one is slightly hazardous. Number zero is normal material. So if you have zero here and zero here, that would be fine. Reactivity, zero is stable. Zero is always good. One is unstable if heated. Two, violent chemical change. Three, shock and heat may detonate. That would be very dangerous, like explosives. And number four, may detonate. So definitely the fours are always the most dangerous thing. If you're driving behind a truck that has fours on this NFPA, stay away. And number four, the fourth one is specific hazards. It's going to have some letters or signs. So oxidizers is oxy, acid is acid, alkali or base is ALK, corrosive COR, use no water is W with a cross across it or a line across it, and radiation hazard is going to have this, the famous radiation sign. One of the slides, by the way, that you can use for your presentation, if you are driving by and you see one of those trucks, you can take a picture of the label on that truck and try to identify what kind of chemical is it carrying. Hazardous material information system, which is the third one, the third tool for communicating the hazards, HMIS, relates to everyday exposure. So here, for example, it's quite similar, at least the same colors as the fire diamond, but it has different meanings. H is still blue for health, F red for flammability, and yellow for reactivity, but the white, instead of being special precautions, in this case it's protective equipment. What kind of protective equipment need to be used in this case? So basically same colors as the NFPA diamond. Here's a hazard in the identification system. So again, it shows the different ratings, and here's an example, and here's the diamond, personal protection equipment that need to be used. So it's going to be here under the HMIS at the very bottom. The employer need not affix new labels to comply with the standard if existing labels already convey the required information. So what can you learn from these barrels, for example? They are basically radioactive, so that can be a radioactive material from a nuclear power plant, disposed of fuel or something like that. One important function of the individuals in charge of maintaining MSDS for the employer is to replace current MSDS with the revised version when it is received. So again, the manufacturers might change the composition of that chemical or might change the effects of that chemical, for example. So as soon as they issue a newer version of the MSDS, you have to update your documents and reflect the newer version rather than the old one. Companies can have copies in several locations, so updating all copies requires a conscientious effort by the individuals responsible for maintaining MSDS. If you have multiple sites, if you are an employer and you have multiple sites, you have to again have an up-to-date version of this MSDS in each one of your sites. For employees who work off-site in a head office or something like that, for example, MSDS may be kept at the central location. In an emergency, the employer must have provisions in place to ensure that employees can immediately obtain the required information. Today is not hard, by the way, to have these MSDS on a tablet, for example, on an iPad or on a tablet, on a laptop or a personal computer on site. So this way it can be easily updated, easily maintained, and so on and so forth. So the MSDS may be kept in any form, including operating procedures, where it may be more appropriate to address the hazards of a process rather than the individual hazardous chemicals. So it's going to be part of the process itself. You're going to be using such and such material. This material is dangerous in such and such way. And if exposed, use the following precautions. Things like that. For the employee information and training, employers must provide employees with information and training on hazardous chemicals in their work area at the time of their initial assignment, once they get to the job, and whenever a new chemical or health hazard the employees have not previously been trained about is introduced into their work area. So each time a new hazard occurs or is about to occur, you have to train your employees on how to identify it, how to recognize it, and how to protect against it, and how to remedy it in case of exposure. Training may cover categories of hazard, the different categories that we talked about, including the classes, the DOT classes, including the NFPA and the HMIS, and so on. Employers must inform employees of the location and availability of the list of hazardous chemicals. Where would you find this information? Usually in the material safety data sheets. And the location and availability of material safety data sheets. Employee training shall include at least, this is the minimum in a training program for the employees, methods and observations that may be used to detect the presence or release of a hazardous chemical in the work area, whether it's by color, whether it's by smell, whether it's by any other symptom of exposure, the physical and health hazards of chemicals in the work area, so what's the effect of that chemical, measures employees can take to protect themselves, and details of the employer's specific program, what is the employer going to provide to protect against this exposure. So this is our presentation today about hazard communication. As you can see, it's a very important topic, and many contractors get cited for not having a clear training program, or not having up-to-date material safety data sheets, or not having proper labeling on the containers for the different chemicals, and so on and so forth. I hope you stay safe.